and welcome back to another episode of This Week on Channel 9. I'm Brian Keller.
I'm Dan Fernandez.
Huge news this week.
Windows 7
RTX. Windows 7, baby.
It's gold, Jerry. It's gold.
That's right. So let's jump right into it. Steve Ballmer signed the gold disc.
Yes. And this is via Brandon LeBlanc had the video clip at an event called MGX.
MGX. Microsoft Global. What does the X stand for?
I don't know. Savings.
It's yes.
But it's where the sales and marketing force from worldwide go gather, and it's in Atlanta, Georgia, and they officially signed off on gold.
That's right. That's right. That's a 24 karat DVD you're looking at there. I actually have no idea. But yeah, pretty exciting. So it's starting to become available to us internally. So people are installing. You installed.
I've installed
this morning.
I am running RTM bit of Windows 7 Ultimate.
That's awesome. Well, I have a question for you, Dan. I'll save my questions for a couple slides because the next slide.
This is why we don't let Brian move the slides. To coincide with that, Charles had an interview with a distinguished engineer, Michael Fortin.
Mm-hmm.
And this conversation is about Windows 7 efficiency. How does actually Windows 7, how do they learn all the telemetry data? How do they actually do the management and a bunch of details from that perspective?
So, collecting diagnostics packages, being able to take all the telemetry from people running the betas. Thank you very much for running all that betas and sending us the great information that we can use to bake into the product. This is also one of the guys that was responsible for Vista ReadyBoost and some of the SpeedSep technology there. So all that stuff's alive and well, Charles says, in Windows 7. So just a great interview to coincide with a really great day. So nice interview, Charles.
Now, these are the seven sins of Capcom. I really start sounding like
Count Chocula.
Or what's the one on Sesame Street, too?
Dracula. What is his name?
I don't know. Count Chocula is a cereal, right?
It's the Count. This the count,
count,
right?
Okay.
Yeah.
Number one. So this is a post by Yohai Kiriati on the Windows team blog, and it goes through the seven. These are the top things that ISVs are running into when they try and make their application compatible with Windows 7. These are the things they're going to run into. Version checking is, and we won't go through all of these, but just like version checking is where you actually, rather than say greater than equal to the version number or minor number, you say equal. So then it looks for exactly the Windows XP version, sees that it's not there, and then says, you must have Windows XP or higher.
So then when the service pack comes out or you get a hot fix that changes the version number, your apps no longer install or no longer work. I hate that.
Exactly. Yeah. So one of the things you can do is right-click and say, do the run compatibility mode to so that it's XP.
Yeah, my mom's actually, not going to figure that out. Sorry,
but,
Mom.
Yeah, but there is at least, that workaround for people when it's just the version check. Now, there
That's
may be
the
other
developer's fault right there, yeah.
Yeah, so some of the other stuff is session isolation and ways like low-privilege services, like UI services, can't talk to high-privilege where, something that's sandboxed can't communicate to something that can do anything it wants to. As you can imagine, if something that was sandboxed could talk to it, then it would have full privileges potentially, right? Because it would just inherit things like high DPI, where if you're writing have legacy Windows Forms applications, I've run into this where Windows Forms is not high DPI aware. So if you change to 120 DPI in your machine, which is really easy to do in 7, and you've been able to do this since even XP, probably.
But it's much more obfuscated in Vista to do that.
Yes.
Yeah.
The issue there is because it's not DPI aware, your buttons will be all over the place, your layout won't go.
Yeah.
WPF at least is high DPI aware. So that way it'll actually re-render sort of agnostic to your DPI.
So what's the solution for the Windows Forms developer? They have to actually check to see whether or not you're running in.
Yeah, there's a number of things they really gotta see in terms of how they do layout or find ways to do relative positioning versus absolute positioning.
Okay.
Right. So it's it's always gonna be 20% from this distance, and the key thing is for all these, there's links back to the compatibility cookbook and a number of different resources for you to see. And even after these are just how you get your app to work.
Right.
Then it's how can you take advantage of the key features, right?
Right.
So whether it's multi-touch, the new taskbar features, everything that you can imagine from within there.
Cool. Great post, Yohai.
Yeah.
So here are my questions that I have for you. So okay, now you've got Windows 7 RTM installed.
Let's go to the... I'm a developer.
What is the gold version number?
So it is 6.1.7600.16385.
Gotcha.
And so if anybody has those...
Those winning numbers.
Those winning numbers. We should play
them. You
have
10 minutes to call. Because you're in trouble because you probably downloaded it off BitTorrent. But anyway.
Exactly.
So the version of .NET Framework that actually ships with it.
.NET 3.5 SP1, which is 3.5.30729.
Okay. And then we won't have you call this out, but this is the user agent that ships with Ultimate, which does not have Silverlight installed.
Yes, Windows 7 does not have Silverlight installed. You may get it from an OEM where it would have it installed, or... I'd say if you were buying a new PC, or some of the apps that you get from a PC may have it installed.
Sure.
But in a totally clean install, it won't have it. And this is mine, which you can see is the Ultimate, which is why you get the Media Center PC in there. But that is the user agent. So.
Okay. All right. And then the number one question, when can we get it?
When can we get it? So August 6th.
MSDN subscribers and TechNet subscribers get it August 6th.
Correct.
Right. And then the rest of the world, so sort of general availability, is October 22nd.
Correct.
Right. And then there's a whole bunch of other answers if you're a partner or an OEM or all sorts of different matrix of answers here. So we'll provide a link back to where you can read more.
Yeah, Brandon's blog has the full details.
Exactly. Yep. So Microsoft contributing to the Linux kernel. This
outside of crazy Windows news, we now have the other stuff.
Yeah,
we're
done with Windows 7, so now we're going to go work on Linux for a while, right? No, so this is the Twitterverse was kind of blowing up with this over the weekend, and lots of people were talking about this. What this really is that we have a Hyper-V product, a virtualization product, and in order for Hyper-V to have a really good experience, there's certain integration drivers that you need to install. So like if you spin up a Hyper-V image that runs Windows Server or Windows XP or Windows Vista, Windows 7, you end up installing a set of drivers that allow the outside hypervisor to talk to the OS that's running inside, and you get better mouse integration and copy-paste. And actually, no, you don't get copy-paste, but you get other things like that, the ability to map drives, what have you. What we've done is we've actually contributed the same level of driver experience back to the Linux kernel so that future Redis will be able to run in a hypervisor shell with something of the same experience. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, this is like dogs and cats living together.
Yeah,
it really is. If it was April Fool's Day, we'd be like, gotcha, suckers.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, we'd contribute source code to the Linux kernel.
Yep. And there's a whole big controversy we won't get into about how Microsoft is anti-GPL license, and now this means that we've actually had to, at least in this instance, agree to the GPL, and so there's a whole bunch of stuff involved there. Not going to deal with that. We'll have our lawyers on the show next week for a heated 90-minute session for you. No, we're not going
to
do that.
It'd be hilarious if my lawyer could talk to your lawyer and be like, I'm not going to confirm or deny the answer to that question.
Exactly. So speaking of dogs and cats living together, so we also just released Gestalt on Tuesday.
Yes.
So that was part of Jeff's team.
Sure. This is Nishant Kathari and Joshua Allen on Thomas Lewis's team. And this is Mix Online. So visit mix.com, I believe, is the URL.
Yep.
And then / Gestalt. So what this is a set of JavaScript libraries. You have to have Silverlight installed. And what they do is you can do inline Ruby or Python code that's then sent to the dynamic language runtime, the DLR, that then executes, right? So it's like JavaScript that takes this stuff and then passes it over to... the DLR, and then it actually executes code. So the goal is to have like a very view source, as opposed to say like compiling a ZAP or having to be in a heavyweight, I'd say, tool like Visual Studio. You can just do inline script very easily, and here you can see like a very simple hello world.
Okay, so the idea is that instead of using inline JavaScript, or in addition to using inline JavaScript to write all of my dynamic page manipulation and what have you,
right,
I can write Ruby or Perl to basically do the same thing now.
I don't know if it's Perl, but I know it's Ruby and Python.
Oh, sorry,
for sure.
Ruby and Python. Yep. Okay, gotcha. And then it's so you have to have Silverlight on the client in order to run this.
Yes.
And then Silverlight's responsible for then taking that Python and Ruby and interpreting it and then turning it back into something that you do on the page.
Because it's a dynamic language runtime, it takes code that's run and executes it dynamically, and it's basically accessing either the HTML DOM or building XAML on the fly. Right, so I can be like building a XAML clock or something, right? And there's, you know, some tick event or something that's firing.
Okay, this sounds all right for V1. When is it going to support J Sharp?
I think they're way ahead of you. The .js file, I assume that was J Sharp.
Oh, right, of course.
Yes, and jQuery, named after J Sharp.
Excellent.
Yes. Take credit for everything.
That's right. So Silverlight FX 3. So this is from Nikhil Kothari.
Yes.
And this is a project that basically gives you a framework for building rich internet applications.
Yeah,
so we've talked about this before.
Yeah, we have talked about this before in the context of just really easy, cool, reusable effects and transitions.
Mm-hmm.
Nikhil's kind of built this up to be including things like an application model. So like, let's say we needed to build a real world RIA application,
right?
One of the Continental Airlines case studies or something like that, where you want application model stuff, right? We've talked about MVVM. This has MVVM built in. It has a lot of support for IOC containers, so inversion control.
Mm-hmm.
What else does it have? The user interface stuff. Just a number of things where it's really built, like if you're building you want a fully featured Silverlight application, I think this is a great place to start.
Right.
And of course, Prism and some of the other ones we've mentioned.
I was going to say Prism. So Prism's for WPF, right? Or is that also for Silverlight?
Too.
It is for Silverlight. So how's Prism different than Silverlight FX? Are they just different models?
Yeah, I think they have different features. Like a number of the things for Silverlight FX are, in my opinion, more on the visual side, started more on the visual side, but also enabled you to have declarative things for views, right? So like the idea of being like I can declaratively change something within the presentation layer.
Gotcha.
Right. So there's some things and how this works with Prism. Something we should invest.
An exercise for the reader.
So
the news here is that version 3.1 is now available as of July 16th and it's compatible with Silverlight 3.
Yes.
So excellent. Nice work. And so speaking of Silverlight 3, here is...
We've got lots of stuff for Silverlight this week.
Robbie Ingebritten.
Ingebretson.
Ingebretson, sorry, Robbie.
And he gave the Design for Developers talk, which was my favorite pre-con at Last Mix.
Yep.
And what this is a set of styles that you can just import. So, and they're really sort of simple, clean. They almost remind me of the Sketchflow style in terms of the buttons and not having, say, the buttons don't have 3D toggles, for example, like the sliders that you can see here are pretty minimalist.
Yeah.
But you can take them, just add them as a skin, and then boom, you can use them in your Silverlight apps.
Boom goes the dynamite. Nice. So Silverlight Toolkit is updated with a new control. This is the tree map control.
Yeah.
And so just looking at this control, if anyone uses Spacemonger, it's one of the tools that Dan and I use all the time. It's a really great tool for just looking at your hard disk. But what's cool about it is it has this great visualization that shows you rectangles that represent the size of the file. So if you've got this huge VHD file off to here and it's occupying a quarter of your drive, it's going to occupy a quarter of the space of the diagram, kind of like a, what are those, the tag clouds? Do the same thing where the tag...
Yeah, where depending on how many items are tagged, that item is larger.
Exactly.
Yeah, so this is that sort of same concept. Now, the cool part is it's a reusable, and the goal here was to build different ways to visualize data, right? Mm-hmm. So they have pie chart, graphs, all this stuff. This tree map control, and it comes with a bunch of samples, and this is the online version, so you can actually just play with it before. It's really cool to be able to do this and not have to write any code.
Oh, yeah.
Or just in terms of the visualization, because, you know, you start looking at, okay, what are my current dimensions, and then start doing sort of the math.
The percentages.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. So it's like a lot of stuff would be involved in being able to reuse that. So.
Yeah, exactly. So very cool. Updating the Silverlight Toolkit.
Yes.
And from Peter Brown here, who's one of our previous show-off winners, he submitted the Silverlight Synthesizer. So this is cool.
I think it's Pete.
Sorry, Pete. He submitted the Silverlight. The day we get the all the names right on this show is the day that I think that's just our last episode. We just had to be done at that point.
So we know him from
Show Off.
Show Off contest where he submitted the Commodore 64 emulator,
which is awesome.
Running in Silverlight.
Yep. And so now he's got a new project he's working on. This is the Silverlight synthesizer. So basically allows you to have this keyboard layout, and then you can manipulate all the different sound waves. Kind of reminds me of the sample that Dan Waters posted to Coding for Fun not too long ago, where he basically breaks down how do you deal with audio within an application. So Pete's kind of having his a different look at that by being able to play the piano or keyboard and have an equalizer pad and everything else.
Yeah, speed something up, slow it down, you know, play with and fiddle with sound.
Yep, exactly.
And all based in Silverlight and is the cool part, right?
All the source code's available too. So, and he's actually listed some bugs that he has right now, so I think he's looking for help from people to kind of iron those out. So another Coding for Fun sample. This is a simple shooter game with Silverlight.
Yeah, Roger Guess. Goal is, if you're building your first, say, Silverlight game, and this is using VB or C#, you want to do things like game loops, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe you've never seen game loops. You got to do collision detection. Some of the core concepts in building a game.
2D graphics 101.
2D graphics 101. So I am doing matrix math, where something is going both in an X and Y coordinate, and how do I keep that tracking where it had its last position, next position.
Yeah. Well, you don't really have to deal with matrix math so much in 2D games. It's 3D games where it gets really tricky.
Well, you do. It's just a 2D matrix.
Yeah. All right. All right, Neo. So...
Source code is available. Project is on CodePlex.
Larry Larson, this is really cool. He put together a post on Channel 9 this last week to commemorate the U.S. lunar landing July 20th. And
40th anniversary.
The 40th anniversary, that's right. And so he basically put together all these pictures into a photo synth, which is awesome, to take all these pictures that that were from the original lunar landing and then the Apollo 17 landing as well, and then just put them together and stitch them, and you can kind of zoom in, and it gives you all the key mappings as well. Actually, one of the things I really like about his post is he gives you all the hotkeys that you can press for manipulating a synth that I actually didn't even know you could do a lot of that stuff before. But this is super cool, and
he's got even higher res images coming.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. I'll keep it at that. There's cool stuff coming.
Nice.
There's more.
Nice.
Yes.
So
wait, there's more.
In one of them, you can actually see the film crew in the background. So.
If only.
They're going to hire Peter Jackson to actually fake the Mars landing, too, I heard.
Oh, so, that'd be good.
That'd be really good. Yeah. Bring back some hobbits and stuff.
Why is there an orc in my soup?
So, codepaste.net, what's this?
Okay, so Rick Strahl, some people may know him. And you're familiar, for people that use Twitter, there's a well-known service called TwitPic that makes it really easy to share photos. You upload a photo, and it gives you a URL back, and you can integrate it into applications. This service is called CodePaste.net, and it's effectively the same thing, except for code snippets. So I want to be able to say, man, this bug sucks. And rather than having to go to, say, my blog or Tumblr or one of these other things and upload your code, you can just do a quick snippet. It links to the snippet. There's sort of the unique ID for it. And that snippet becomes social. Other people can reuse it, can share it, et cetera.
That's awesome. So now do you ever get the chance to, like, remove that code? Like, oops, I accidentally pasted a password into this code, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I believe you get the option to log in, so
okay,
I have to assume.
Okay, so it is stateful then.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And now it does have the ability to do code colorization for like VB, HTML, C#.
J#.
No, J#. Maybe Java, maybe.
Oh, okay, all
maybe.
Right. There's hope after all.
Actually, no. Now that I think about it, I think it's just .NET.
Oh, okay. Well, J#. There you go.
Not J#.
So this
Speaking
is our
of the Twitterverse.
Our weekly messing with Hanselman segment. So
yes.
So Scott recently changed his avatar, and I guess it took people by storm. People didn't really like the fact that Scott wasn't using his old avatar. The new one was a little bit more casual. People think that it didn't look like him. And so it basically started this whole storm of the Scott Hanselman avatar weekend where everyone across the Twitterverse was changing their pictures to look like everyone was changing.
When Ashton Kutcher did it, it was awesome.
It was really good. And they basically changed their pictures to look like Scott. So we love these. These are some of the safe for work versions.
Yes, that is the thing. These are the safe for work versions. Yep. You people are disgusting and should be ashamed of yourselves for the things you did to that poor Scott Hanselman.
I know.
Borat's bathing suit? That was completely unnecessary. So that's my contribution to the IMASP.N, so can you, which is a play on the Stephen Colbert.
Nice. So time's for Picks of the Week.
Picks of the Week! Yes.
So last week was kind of a sad episode for you. We talked about Popfly going off the air. And you kind of got a little quiet when I asked you about it, and people noticed that. But you've been hard at work trying to revive just a little slimmer of Popfly here. Stop doing that and tell us what you got here.
Okay, so we were working with Ben Anderson and Adam Nathan from the old Popfly team to build what's called the Popfly Gain Downloader. This is available on Coding for Fun. Yeah, it's not officially supported, etc. But it seems to work on every game that I've thrown at it. What it does is it goes to, and your game has to be shared, and this is only games, so not Popfly mashups. What it does is go there, looks at the resources within your game, downloads those games, dynamically builds a ZAP, dynamically builds an HTML file, and then actually lets you play from that local HTML file the ZAP within it. So
nice.
It does everything that you need to basically take that game offline. So until August 24th, you can use this tool to download not even just games maybe I built, but you can download other people's games
as really?
Well.
So yeah. There's no permissions issues or anything like that?
As long as they're shared, and shared is like the public, if you will.
Right.
Then you can download your favorite game where it's like, man, this guy had an awesome one. One of my favorites, of course, is Adam's Crayon Cannon.
Oh, that was a great game.
Yeah, so I downloaded that. I'm like, yeah, I'll play this every now and then.
Yep.
And I started playing again and realized that I suck. it does a couple things like removing the high score and that stuff, but that's kind of what you'd expect.
My
from
high
an
score is gone.
Version. Yeah.
This is going to just turn into that Seinfeld episode where they have to transport the Frogger game across the street.
Or walking with the Popfly server.
Yeah, exactly.
I did one good thing in my life, Jared. All the Seinfeld references today. So
yeah.
If you're a Popfly game fan, take this. And you'll have a bunch of games to play with.
So then is somebody creating a repository then, like another repository off to the side where you can then
you
go
can
download those?
You could potentially re-upload those. In fact, we were considering, like, at least for Coding for Fun, to have like the top 25 apps.
Popfly Graveyard.
Yeah. .com.
Register it now. Someone will.
So your pick of the week.
So my pick of the week is a little bit self-promoting because this is a 10-4 episode
Shocker.
That I filmed. but really it's promoting a feature that the Team System team has worked hard on, and it's a historical debugger. And I think this is going to, we've talked about this a little bit in the past. I think this is
For sure.
really going to revolutionize the way that we debug applications. So, there's a lot of use cases for this. How often are you debugging an application and you hit a breakpoint down here and you realize that what you really wanted to examine was way up here in the call stack, so you've got to rerun your application, set a new breakpoint. Oh, that's the wrong spot. I've got to set a different one, and you're basically playing breakpoint.
You're
ping
losing
pong.
Context when when a new bug comes in on that issue that was 2 weeks ago. You don't remember what the breakpoints were for that issue.
Yeah. So what you can do with a historical debugger is you can actually treat it kind of like a VCR, where you can rewind back in time. It captures relevant events, like when did an exception get thrown and swallowed, when did registry keys get read and written, and you can actually, even though it's not supported, you can create your own custom events as well and plug that into the historical debugger model. So that's kind of the one like F5 sitting in front of your computer debugging scenario, which I show in this 10-4 video. What I'll be showing in future videos and what Habib Haydarian has already talked about on his blog is you can actually run this while you're running your suite of unit tests, while you're running your manual tests, while you're running your web tests, any other tests that you might want to run. You can have this turned on in the background, and assuming it's managed code, it can capture it, and then let's say you hit a bug, you can actually have that automatically attached to the bug. So the developer gets in, sees, hey, I've got this bug from this unit test run or from this manual test run. Open it up. You've got all the historical debugger information right in front of you. You just step through as if the app was running on your own machine. And presto, you can debug your application. It's pretty sweet. So check out the video if you're interested to see kind of a 10-minute video of how that experience works.
Wow, 10 minutes.
Yep.
11:20, sorry.
Well, you've got bumpers
sorry.
On the end. Yeah, so it's a 10-minute demo. I've got to talk about my
Trebek
dog.
Trebek would not handle that. That'd be a wrong answer, sir.
What is a 10-minute demo? And that's it. So we'll see you next week.
Congrats to the Windows team.
Right on.